Okay, so welcome everyone to the lecture Architectures of Supercomputers. If anyone wants to hear Übersetzerbau 3, this is the wrong room you're in, but obviously no one's jumping. Okay, so first order of business. We have a small problem. The other lecture, compiler construction, special topics in compiler construction, is colliding with this time slot, with this room. So the question would be how to handle this situation. And one suggestion would be to move to a different room with more space, however, different time slot.
Which time slot?
In 2 hours, essentially, so 12. 12 to 2. Okay, so that's not possible. Perfect. Then we could. So Wednesday. Monday, anyone? Monday, 2 to 4? No. That's very unfortunate. Tuesday, 2 to 4? Anybody who could not attend the lecture on Tuesday? Thursday, not Tuesday.
Thursday,
2 to 4. Thursday, 2 to 4. Anyone who cannot make it? 2, 3. Okay.
Yeah.
4. 5.
It's 2 to 4, right?
2 to 4, yeah.
Yeah. I actually have my staff.
Okay, Thursday 2 to 4 isn't going to work out either. Okay, and Wednesday 12 to 2 doesn't work either way, right? Okay.
Tuesday?
I don't have a room for Tuesday. Thursday morning, I don't have a room for Thursday morning. That's the problem.
Thursday evening.
I already asked for Monday, didn't I?
Yeah. What time on Monday?
2 to 4.
No.
Starting
from 4.
Yeah. Okay. We'll figure something out. We'll figure something out. I will meet with the other lecturer after this date. So I know your preferences. In any case, the lecture will be recorded. So if you miss any of those lectures, you can still look at it on the internet. I don't know how long it takes until they're uploaded?
Directly after.
So they won't be edited. Will they be edited? So, or will they just be uploaded as is?
Just uploaded like this.
Okay. Yay. Okay. Good. Right. So,
excuse me.
Yes, please.
Is it possible to like switch on that light, maybe right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Much better.
More better. Yeah.
More better.
Yeah.
Do you like it dark?
Yeah.
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 Like that? It's probably not good for the camera, huh? Yeah. Okay. Yay. So, one more try. Ta-da. So, welcome everyone to the lecture Architectures of Supercomputers. My name is Thomas Heller. I work at the chair for computer architecture. My office is in the 7th floor. If you go out the elevator, turn left and then go straight ahead. Okay, if you ever need any further assistance. So what will we talk about? So the outline of the lecture will be a little bit like this. So first of all, we discuss some organizational matters, as we did already. Then there will be a small introduction. After that, we will have a basic introduction into computer architecture. Okay. For that matter, I would like to ask you who studied computer science in their bachelor's. Okay. Mechanical engineering. Okay. Electrical engineering. Kinda. Okay. Anything else?
Mechatronics.
So mechatronics. So related. Okay. So, what's your background? If I do you guys know what registers are?
Yeah.
Okay. No?
No.
No? Okay. Caches.
Yeah.
Yes, no, okay. All right. Cool. It's going to be interesting for you guys. Excellent. This will be very important for you then. If you have any if something's unclear, please do ask. And for that reason, I would also like to ask you, even though it's recorded, please come to the lecture. First of all, it's very boring for me if I just stand in front of the camera. Second of all, if you have any questions, the lecture is there to ask, okay? Perfect. After the computer architecture introduction, we will move on to the road to exascale. Does anybody have an idea what this means? Okay, so I guess the majority of people comes from India, okay. I see no Chinese people here. Ah, sorry, missed you,
too.
Pakistan as well? Okay, excellent. I'm not sure if India actually does have a an exascale program. Do you guys know? No. Okay. So we will see what this means in the next few moments, I guess. Then after that, we will discuss the most important thing. One of the most important things in a supercomputer, namely the network. Okay. And depending on how much time we have, we will take a tour of the top 500. Anyone has an idea what top 500 stands for in this?
Top 500 supercomputers.
Yeah, top 500 supercomputers. Okay, so let's start with the organization. So the lecture will be, today, starting at 10:15. If nothing changes in that very room. The lecture will be mostly given by me. There might be some time slots which I can't make. For that, I will write you an email. The exercises will be given by Shima Hossein Sadeh. She's my colleague. She will guide you as a tutor through the exercises. And the exercises will be in room 00153. 113, that's on the ground floor, over there, I think.
What if we can't make the exercise?
Then you can't make it. If you can't make it, then which day could you make? Which time could you make?
Thursday from 8 to 12. Friday from 8 to 10. Thursday afternoon after 2.
Okay.
Wednesday after 2, Tuesday from 8 to 12, and Mondays from 12 in the afternoon.
Is it just you that can't make it? Who can't make it, or you? So hands up for if you can't make this time slot. So around. That's fine. That's fine. So 4 people. Okay. Yeah, we will. I will try to come up with a solution for that. If so. You're correct here. Okay, we will come up with a solution for that. That will work for everyone. So do you know if you share the same schedule? No. Okay. Perfect. Okay, let's discuss this afterwards, okay? Great. So the exam will be a written exam. Okay. I have no time slot there. This is usually scheduled. This is usually done by a centralized schedule. Okay. So we will know it probably after the Christmas holidays. Okay. The only thing that you have to do is to register for the exam on Mein Campus. Okay? That's very important, because if you don't register, I can't examine you. Okay? The registration will be open, I think, in 1 or 2 weeks. Okay? The last thing I would like to ask you to register also on Studon, okay? On this URL here, I will do all the communication regarding dates or changes in the schedule or anything via Studon. Also, the slides will be on Studon. Yes. You don't need a password. Oh, okay. Okay, so if you. Oh, come on. Okay. Oh, God. Okay, so this one, right? Okay, you got your student ID, right? Those cryptic letters and numbers. Okay, and you can, if you do single sign-on, for example, you will get to this portal here. Okay, and there you can put in your username, that's your student ID, and the password, and then you should be able to sign on. Okay, and then you should be able to register for the course. Okay, and then you will, I forgot to, right, then you will see, something like this, okay? And here you have the slides then, okay?
It tells me that it's not possible to register even though I'm logged in. It says Anmeldezeit, keine Anmeldung möglich.
Huh. Okay. Okay. Sorry about that. Let's fix it real quick. All right. Now it should be possible.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so please do so in the next few... Come on. In the next few days, okay? So the exercises, etc., will be uploaded there as well, okay? Along with other additional material. Okay, so, right. So if anyone objects for the video recording, please speak up now. Otherwise, we will just continue and assume that everyone's fine with that. Okay? All right, so introduction. First of all, what do we need supercomputers for? Okay, so since most of you have mechanical engineering, mechatronics, or something related, electrical engineering background, any idea what a supercomputer might be used for? Why we have this lecture?
To solve fluid flow problems, for example, which have millions of equations.
Right. Well, one or two equations usually, but millions of degrees of freedom usually, yeah, yeah. Right? So, for example, this one here, right, where you have some plane structure and you want to calculate the flow of the air around the plane, right? This is often done on large scale clusters of supercomputers. Okay, so I guess most of you then study computational engineering?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All of you, or is there anyone else? Any other study?
Computer science.
Computer science, okay. Great. So, most of you will get familiar with those kinds of problems, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So, another very interesting topic people use supercomputing infrastructure for is this kind of things here, right? Anyone got an idea what this could be? Colliding of galaxies. Okay, so those represent two galaxies. Each of those little shiny dots is a star in the galaxy, and this simulation is doing a collision of those two galaxies. Okay, you usually need lots of compute power there as well. Okay, the next big application is this one here. No, this is computational drug design. Okay. So in order to design new drugs, right, and to measure their effectiveness, etc., without doing animal testing or human testing, we can nowadays use to some degree our computers to do parameter studies, etc., to simulate the interaction with the human body. Okay. Then the very big application. Weather forecast, right? So this is Hurricane Sandy, I think. This is a picture from a European Weather Institute, Climate Institute, which actually predicted the trajectory of the Hurricane Sandy very precisely using a supercomputer. And it's not only weather forecasting, it's also climate change simulations, etc. Here it's actually very interesting. I don't know if you followed the development of those climate change forecasts, etc., given out by the IPCC. They usually change their minds every now and then, right? And that's mainly because they have access to bigger and better resources, so their models to actually simulate the climate get better and better, and we still don't fully understand neither weather or climate. So the better the computers get, the better models can be developed, the better we can predict those phenomena. Okay. Anyone got an idea what this is? So this is a flame simulation, okay? This is of particular interest if you want to study combustion engines, for example, or other processes where you need to burn something, okay? And here we are with the material sciences, okay? Those are nanotubes, and you can simulate those nanotubes as well, okay? This picture here is taken from a simulation of a fusion reactor, okay? And this shiny torus here is the plasma, okay? And in order for a fusion reactor to work, we need to somehow bend this plasma that's in the fusion reactor to not touch any of the outer layers of the skins of the reactor, right? And that's usually done with some magnets, with some magnets that are mounted up here, and the magnets control how the plasma resides inside of this outer torus here. And that's something you really can't test, right? You can't build such a structure up front and then push some very hot plasma through it. You actually have to simulate it to see how it behaves. And the newest fusion reactor actually was purely built on the result of the simulation. Okay, and it has some pretzel-shaped torus. Okay, and unfortunately, last but not least, the weapon testing and influences of bombs and explosion research, etc. Okay, and this is actually very interesting. In the 1970s, when the world community decided that that throwing nuclear bombs might not be such a good idea, not even for testing purposes, the nuclear testing was completely banned on the whole planet. And the only way to make sure that the nuclear bombs that we have nowadays don't explode or leak radioactivity is actually through simulation. Okay? So, and this is one of the biggest driving factors to build bigger and better computers, okay? But the other sciences, especially climate and weather forecasting and computational fluid dynamics, make up, are more important, gain more and more traction. Okay, so let's take a quiz. What is a supercomputer, okay? So, is this thingy here a supercomputer? Or the computer that's built inside? First, anyone knows what this is?
Exactly.
Nope. It's the Apollo landing thingy. Okay. And it's the first one of the first programmable computers. That was built there, the Apollo guidance computer, okay, and the project surrounding this Apollo guidance computer actually defined modern computer, modern software engineering. So, judging by the standards they had in the 1960s, is this a supercomputer then? Yes, okay. Well, it did compute a lot, right? I'm not sure if it's a supercomputer. Let's see. So this is actually a real computer now. Anyone knows what this is? So this is a Cray supercomputer. Okay, and this design with the benches, etc. This was a very well designed computer, right? And they were able to actually put in a lot of compute power in there, right? Because of the design, they were able to pull out the heat that was produced in the computer. And that's actually a supercomputer by definition. So most of the time, something is something merely by definition. And this was built by Cray. And Cray is also called the supercomputer company. Okay, so most of the supercomputers in the top 500 are actually built by Cray. And this was tailored towards the needs of the simulations that we saw. So numerical throughput, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So your smartphone, is this a supercomputer?
No.
Probably not, right? Also, not by definition. And of course, a smartphone serves a very different use case, right? So, is this a supercomputer? Yes, hands up, if you think yes. Okay, why not? So, is anybody else undecided or?
Undecided, yeah.
Undecided, okay.
Probably could be anything. It just looks like a server.
That's like too many computers.
It looks like a computer room. Yes.
It's a server room.
It's a server room, right? So actually, this picture is from one of the Google data centers. Okay. So it's not a supercomputer. Okay, but almost. So. Is this a supercomputer? Yes?
No.
No? Well, actually, it kind of is, right? This is a self-driving car, right? And in order to do self-driving, you have to have a lot of computational power. So what they, what Audi did in for this specific car is they actually put in a lot of computers in the trunk. Right, to actually perform the automatic driving, right? So it's small but powerful. So is this a supercomputer?
Yes.
Yes. Last year, no one laughed when I so yes, this is the Cori supercomputer, and those are the one that we'll deal with in the lecture. So the question really is, what's the difference between this server room and this server room, right? It looks almost similar. So, that's something that we'll hopefully cover. Okay, so the things that makes a computer super is usually, well, it's built to accelerate science, right? If you build such a computer, then you usually want to help your scientists to be able to solve problems faster, to solve new problems, to come up with new models, right? And most of the problems there are numerical number crunching problems, right? So it boils down to solving big linear systems of equations usually, and for that you have most of the time matrix multiplications, matrix vector multiplications, etc. Right, all the fun things that you will learn in the next few semesters, right? And every new generation of supercomputer has the purpose to solve bigger and bigger problems, right? And they are usually very tightly integrated to get high performance. Okay, so if you look at this room here, well, you have lots of racks, lots of computing systems here, right? But most of the time, they really are off-the-shelf computers, right? Where you can either go to some website, or, well, maybe not go to your next door computing shop, but you can order those pieces on the internet very easily, right? Not so much with those thingies here, right? And also not so much with this one here, right? So they are usually special built purpose machines, okay? So the definition on Wikipedia says a supercomputer is a computer with a high level of computing performance compared to a general purpose computer, right? So by that definition, maybe anything that you can build for any amount of money that's better by some measurement than the usual laptop or whatever you can put on your desk could be considered a supercomputer. Okay, and the next sentence, performance of a supercomputer is measured in floating point operations per second instead of million instructions per second. Well, yeah, so we'll see what this means. So let's look at the performance of the things we saw earlier, right? So the Apollo guidance computer in the first picture had a frequency of 0.043 megahertz. Okay, your washing machine has a better computer, better processor in it nowadays, right? But still, it brought people to the moon and back. So that's a pretty good achievement, I think. The next computer we saw, this round thingy, the Cray 1, had 80 megahertz. Okay, still not as highly clocked as your regular smartphone. It had one core, so imagine this huge thing only had one compute core. Okay, and it was able to execute 250 million floating point operations per second, which is pretty neat. Okay, the Apollo computer didn't do any floating point math at all. Okay, so an iPhone 7, which is 3 years old, now has a clock frequency of 2.34 gigahertz, right? Which is quite a jump from 1975 to 2015, right? And it has 4 CPU cores and 6 GPU cores, and is able to perform 300 billion floating point operations per second. Right. That's 1,000 more than the Cray 1 supercomputer. So by that metric, right, your usual iPhone would have been a supercomputer 40 years back. Okay. So the next one, the Cori supercomputer, it's also very interesting. It has a frequency, so each core has a clock frequency of 1.4 gigahertz, so a little less than the iPhone. However, it has 620,000 cores, right? So not really comparable, right? So and it also is able to execute almost 28 petaflops. So okay, so, and that's a good characteristic of a supercomputer nowadays, right? It has lots and lots of cores, okay, and it also usually takes up lots and lots of energy, okay, and we will look into if energy might be a problem, why the frequency started to drop, how you can house so many cores, and where do the floating point operations come from. Okay. So the top 500 list is compiled 2 times per year. Okay. In June and in November. So the next list will come out mid-November. So very exciting. We can celebrate the new number one system, if there will be any, in November. And the largest system is a US-based system. It's called Summit, okay? And it has 2.2 million cores, right? So the Cori supercomputer isn't even on the list anymore, right? It's 2 years old and it's not even in the top five anymore, okay? And yeah, so the next one in the list is a Chinese system with 10.6 million cores. Okay, so that's pretty intense. Right. Yeah, so the only Europe-based supercomputer is the number six here, right? Which is Pisteint. It's located in Switzerland, in Lugano. And it only has 60,000 cores, okay? But we might see a new system from Germany in November, maybe. Yeah. So let's leave it at that. Are there any questions to the introduction? Okay. So now, in order for you to get up to speed and to know where the performance comes from, what a computer is built of, what are the basic techniques and strategies that are used inside of a CPU and inside of a computer, I will guide you through the basics of computer architecture. Okay. So first of all, a little history lesson. So where it all started, probably around 3,000 years before Christ, with the abacus, right? It was a calculating tool where you could perform multiplications, additions, etc., way faster than with your usual brain, right? This helped the merchants and the and everyone a lot, right? But it's not really a computer, right? Well, you can compute things with it, so it's kind of a computer, right? But it's not a computer in the modern sense, okay? The next step in development is semi-automated computing machines, okay? And those are the automated looms, right? Invented during the Industrial Revolution, where those machines actually were able to loom different patterns for the cloths that they produced, right? And those were actually kind of programmable computers. Okay. So with that, we after we had those automated looms, the development of the computer accelerated, right? So only 20 years later, we have the Babbage Difference Engine, right? It's a complete mechanical computer. Okay, actually, Babbage was never able to build such a machine. Eventually, he was declared to be insane and lost his job, etc. However, the Babbage and Babbage's environment was very interesting. One of the students of Babbage actually kind of invented programming. Okay, this was Ada Lovelace, a woman who actually took the ideas of Charles Babbage and thought, hey, we could actually write algorithms with it. Or, well, they didn't call it algorithms back then, but instructions on how to compute various things. So, and this machine was actually able to differentiate given functions, okay? Completely mechanical build. I think this one is in the Berkeley Museum of Computer History, and it's actually functional. It was built after the plans of Babbage, so it actually did work out eventually. Okay, so and as said, after that the development really accelerated. Okay, so It kind of all started in 1930-ish, where a relay-based adder was demonstrated. Okay, now the electrical engineers come into play, right? Because our modern computers are built of are usually very simplified, just switches which are being turned on and off depending on what input they get, kind of. And what we see is a transition from mechanical devices towards electronics without any moving parts except for electrons. Okay, so in 1933, a relay-based adder was demonstrated. That means that if you turn a switch based on some decoding, this device was actually able to perform an addition. Okay, still completely mechanical, but anyways, 1941, the SUSE Set 3 was finished, and it was one of the first programmable modern computers, I'd say. And you can actually take a tour here, I think downstairs, where you can actually see a working version of the Set 3. Okay, and since the computers back then weren't polished, they weren't put in such nice cases. The first bug was found in 1945, and it was actually a actual real moth that got stuck in one of the relays, which made the computer not functioning correctly anymore. And that's where the word bug comes from. Okay. 1946, the ENIAC was revealed. ENIAC was the first fully electronic computer. Only 10 years later, the Nobel Prize in Physics for the transistor was given out. And the transistors are the basis of every modern computer nowadays. That might change in the future, but that's not our topic. And only 1 year later, the programming language Fortran was invented, right? And you see that the time stepping gets closer and closer, right? Who's familiar with Fortran?
Yeah.
One person? Okay, kinda. Okay. Fortran is still in heavy use today, okay? And it's still actively being developed, right? And 14 years later, Intel releases its first microprocessor, okay? So from the first device that could kind of add something based on relays to the actual first programmable microprocessor, it only took mankind 30 years, right? Well, 34. Only 1 year later, the C programming language was released, right? Without the C programming language, we probably wouldn't have the internet. Okay, so this was a big step, and then 1976, the Cray 1 was released, okay? The one we saw earlier. 1979, the Atari 400 and Atari 800 was released, which marked the beginning of the personal computer. In 1985, the C++ programming language was created, okay? 1991, the Linux kernel was released, right? And so it goes on. So you see it's, so for me, it feels like it was almost yesterday. So it's very interesting that it's, that most of the stuff we're dealing with was developed in the 1970s and 1980s, right? And we only more or less built on top of the things that were invented back then, right? So the Intel Pentium processor was released 1993. The CUDA programming language was released in 2007. The IBM Sequoia supercomputer I think it was the first one who actually was able to perform one petaflop per second, one petaflop per second, yeah. And 2012, the Raspberry Pi, which kicked off the Internet of Things era kind of was released. Okay. So, yeah. So looking at all those steps in the history of computing, what do most of the computers that exist nowadays have in common? I'd say the first thing they have in common are that they are programmable. Okay, so in some sense or another, you can actually put a program on your computer and it does the things that you instructed it to. Of course, there needs to be some storage of the program you want to run, right? You need to store data, obviously, and you need to be able to perform input and to get something back, right? Otherwise, it would be, well, just a lamp or something. Okay, and those four principles actually is what von Neumann postulated, and it's usually referenced as the von Neumann architecture. Okay, it's based on those four principles, and those four principles more or less hold still today. Okay, and it's the one of the most fundamental things in computer architecture. Okay, so the components of a von Neumann architecture is first of all a ALU. Anybody knows what this might stand for? Arithmetic logical union. Right. So this is where all the computation is performed. So additions, Boolean operations, multiplications, what have you, right? Then you have the control unit, okay, which tells the ALU, the bus, the memory, the I/O unit what to actually do. Okay, then we have a bus system, which connects the ALU, the control unit, the memory, and the I/O unit together. So a bus, in its very simplest form, is just a cable. Okay, where electrical signal can travel over. Okay, it also has to have a memory and a unit to do input and output operations. Okay, so those are the very basic components. So, and if we write it down, it looks a little like this. So you have the ALU, right, which is connected to a bus system on the one side. You have the memory, okay. Then you have the control unit, and then you have the input-output. Okay, so very very simplified, right? But if you you might recognize this schematic later on in the lecture. So usually if we present the architecture of a processor, it looks a little more complicated than this, but in essence, it's really just this, okay? And the basic principles are that the instructions are stored in memory, and the other groundbreaking thing is that instructions are linearly addressable. Okay, that means that if I have a program that says add with some operations and then says multiply and then I don't know store something, Okay, this means, which feels natural to us when we read a book or something, right? We go from the first line to the next line, to the next line, to the next line, right? And this linearly addressable means that we can just move from one address to another by just going from by just adding some value to the address. Okay. It has a instruction register which holds the current instruction, and the instructions are executed in sequence. But it also has jumps. Okay, that means usually we execute from here to here to here to here, but sometimes we can have a special instruction that jumps back to the first instruction or to a completely unrelated instruction. Okay, anybody have an idea what this might be used for? Loops, conditions, something like that. And it also follows a binary coding scheme. Okay, that means that every number, everything in a computer is stored in a binary format. Okay, all zero, all one, and that's it. And that's very convenient if you look at the electrical signals that travel through a system, where the zero and one are represented by a specific level of voltage. Okay, so nowadays zero voltage means zero, and I think between 3 and 5 volts then means a one, depending on the actual computer. Okay. So, and here we have the von Neumann scheme again, right? Where you have the bus system, then your central processing unit, the CPU, has the ALU, here it's in German, and the control unit. Right. Here's the bus connecting all the pieces together. Then you have the memory and the I/O unit. Okay. Perfect. Questions so far? Okay. So, let's take a look how we can go from a computer program to instructions. Okay, so let's look at this simple function here. Right, so this is a C function, C++ function, Fortran. Well, Fortran doesn't look like this, but similar. But it's just some program that we put in, right? From some high level language, I'd say. Okay. When we compile it, the compiler transforms this source code into assembly instructions. Okay, does some optimizations, etc. And the assembly instructions, this is for a x86 processor. Bonus question, 64-bit or 32-bit? Nope, 64. You can see it on the register name. Anyways, what it does, it has some push instructions, move instructions, add instructions, pop, and return. Okay, so almost looks like this, right? Kind of. If we neglect those parts, then it almost looks like this. It has this add instructions, which adds those numbers. Okay, a computer still doesn't understand this, right? It's just for us humans to comprehend in some way or another. So this is the assembly language, and this assembly language has a one-to-one mapping to the actual machine instructions. Okay, so the first column here are the addresses. Okay. And everything after those addresses are then the machine instructions. Okay, and this is represented as a hexadecimal number, right? So you might wonder why hexadecimal? Didn't you say binary? Yeah, sure. But it's very easy to transform a hexadecimal number into a binary number. So this is just, again, a representation of the binary, of the actual binary instruction. Okay. And here you can see they are all stored sequentially. And you can execute one after the other. Okay. Great. So in order to execute those instructions in a CPU, we have something that is being called the machine instruction cycle. Okay? And the machine instruction cycle starts with first fetching the instruction, decoding the instruction, fetching the operands, executing the actual instruction, and then writing back the result. Okay. Or as a block scheme, we have the instruction fetcher, which needs to fetch the instruction from some kind of memory interface. Then we decode the instruction. Where we read the stuff from memory into the registers to actually perform the operation in the ALU. So from the instruction decoder, we tell, we mask the registers that we want to use for the instruction. And we also tell the ALU what operation to perform. Okay, so those are the basic five steps that you need to take when executing an instruction, right? All clear? Good. So if we write it down, we have our instruction fetch, instruction decode, operand fetch, execution, and write back, right? And each of those stages takes some amount of time, right? So we have the time here, right? And so we have some unit of time that each of those instructions takes. And in order to execute the next instruction, right, we of course have to start here, right? Okay. Okay, let's leave it at that. So, which brings me to the next topic, right? If you look at those instructions, right, or the different stages an instruction might take, you can see that most of those stages are independent of each other, right? So instead of waiting until the full instruction is executed, what we could do instead is, well, just once we fetch the first instruction and passed on the instruction that we got to the instruction decode phase, well, we could just fetch the next instruction, right? Once the instruction is decoded and passed on to the operating fetch stage, we can decode the second instruction, right? And so on and so forth. Okay. So, and this process here is usually called pipelining, right? This means that we have the opportunity to actually execute multiple instructions in parallel. Okay, so this is the first parallelization strategy that's being applied completely transparently from the programming, right? So, And so the question is, are they really always independent of each other? Well, maybe not, right? If we have this instruction fetch and operand fetch, if we look at those two stages, right, they all have to access the memory, right? And this somehow has to be coordinated, so they can't access the memory system at the same time. Otherwise, the data that they request is kind of interleaved, right? So this is kind of not working out as we expected it, right? So that something has to be done there. And the next question is, what's this? How much do we actually gain from pipelining, from executing the stages in parallel? And if we have more stages, does the performance increase? Do we get more out of it? So again, here's the here's another picture where we have A, B, C, D as the different stages executed sequentially, right, over time. And with pipelining, obviously, we can squeeze them in way better, right? And if we have more stages, just imagine we will make this gap here smaller and smaller the more stages we have, right? Because then we have better overlap. The problem here is that in order to pass the information from one stage to the other, we kind of need transistors and space in our chip to save the intermediate states, right? And this is getting more and more expensive. The other question is there maybe a limit, an upper limit to the actual speed up that we can get? The next big problem really is those conflicts that I mentioned, right? Those conflicts are usually or are called hazards. And in total, we know of three hazards, okay? The first of which are data hazards. So the first is data hazard, the second is control hazards, and the third is a structural hazard, okay? So structural hazard is what we have here, okay? Where we need to access the same component concurrently at the same time, right? So that's not going to work out. A control hazard is similar. So what happens if we have something like if A is bigger than B, then we execute this, and else we execute something else, right? If we follow the scheme that the next instruction always comes next, right? And we just fetch the next instruction, this is not going to work out, right? Because what if A is not bigger than B, right? We actually have to wait until the result is being written back, right? In order to determine, so we need to execute this comparison instruction to actually decide if we take this instruction next or this instruction next. Right. Have you heard of Spectre? Yeah? Okay. And we won't go into detail there. Right, so this is the control hazard that we don't always know the next instruction that we want to execute. Okay. The other hazards are a little bit more complicated. So the data hazards, well, they are equally complicated. If we have, for example, A equals B plus C, and then D equals E plus A, right? If we have those instructions, well, those operations, what we have here is that the addition here, this E plus A, depends on the result of the previous instruction, right? This means that if we look at our pipelining scheme, right, if we fetch the operands here, right, the previous operation is still in process. Right? So we have a problem there that we would need to wait one more time, or one more time point, right, in order to get the result of the previous operation. This is usually called a read after write, right? Because there we need to read the value after it has been written by the previous instruction. The other data hazards are write after read and write after write. Right? Can you imagine a scenario where those two come into play when having this scheme? Where you actually write to something? So, this one? Well, we fetch the instruction here. We fetch the value that has been stored in this variable here, right? Then we execute the increment, so the plus one, and then we write it back, right? So, no, unfortunately not. So in this scheme, actually, we can't get into the situations where we have write after read or write after write. Okay. This only comes into play when we have other things. So let's see. So in order to fight the structural hazards, for example, right? What we could do is, if we consider those two instructions, for example, what we could do is that if we have a third instruction that's doing something completely unrelated to those two instructions, right? So let's say set equals, I don't know, W plus V. Okay. Completely unrelated to those two instructions. So what we could do here is to reorder the instructions and to actually execute this one right before the second one, right? Because they are completely unrelated. Right. So this could be one measure that we could take. The other measure that we could take to fight structural hazards, for example, is that we just have more than one memory unit. We just have more than one execution unit. We just have more of everything, right? Which then results into what we call superscalar execution, right? Where we can have multiple execution executed at the same time, right? And this might then lead to write after read and write after write hazards. Okay. This read after write hazard is actually the easiest of all to resolve, right? Because if we have this situation here, we don't need to squeeze in another instruction really. We only have to remember that, okay, in the previous instruction, we actually calculate the result of A, right? So in the operand fetch phase, we don't need to fetch the instruction. We can just forward the result of the previous instruction to the next instruction and call it a day. So we just keep it in the ALU instruction sets. Okay. So the countermeasures that we can take here is, well, if we don't want to spend any more resources on it, on our chip, the easiest thing we could do, well, we just delay the execution if there is one of those hazards, right? We just, so instead of executing this one right away, we just wait one cycle here and execute the fetch here. We still have a hazard, a structural hazard, so not here. Yeah, so you see where this is going. So we might end up executing it here and then move on, right? So we waste two cycles, right? So this is probably not preferred. So what we want to do instead is to have the superscalar pipelines and out of order execution. So this means that we, so out of order execution means that we look at the next 10 instructions, for example, and see what they depend on. And if we have 10 instructions that are completely independent of each other, we can just execute them as we wish, depending on the resources they need, registers they need, et cetera, et cetera, and call it a day. Especially if we have more than one execution unit, operand fetch unit, et cetera, we can more or less do anything we please. The problem then is that we run into those write after read hazards or write after write hazards, potentially. And for that, we need complex scheduling algorithms like the scoreboard algorithm or the Tomasulu algorithm. Okay, that's essentially all you need to know. Okay, pipelining is great. It usually works most of the time. What we haven't discussed is how to solve the control hazard problem. Okay. What's being done here is that we usually, that a CPU usually tries to predict on which branch is being taken, okay, which works pretty well, actually. So a modern CPU predicts almost, well, I think between 80 and 90% of the branches that you take in your program correctly, okay? It almost never fails, yeah?
Okay,
good question. Let's look at this. Okay, so So let's assume that the decision on which instructions to take is done in the instruction decoder phase. Okay. Then what we could do is, well, we just fetch, for example, 10 instructions, decode those 10 instructions, and then run our algorithm and decide when and how those instructions will be executed. Okay. That's probably take some time. Okay. However, you not only have 10 instructions, right? You have hundreds or millions of instructions. So while you decide on which instructions when to execute, other instructions already execute, right? So this time is neglectable.
And my second question is, if you execute multiple instructions, how does the memory allocation work? Like, does it work in a single memory allocation, or do we need multiple memories also for multiple instructions?
Okay, memory allocation actually isn't covered in this scheme at all, right? So in this scheme, we assume that we have an address space that starts at 0 and ends at 4 billion something, for example, right? If you don't have any operating system or anything, you actually don't need memory allocation, right? Because you know that your address, that the memory you can access starts at 0 and ends at 4 billion. right? So you can use any addresses in between to store your data, right? Of course, this is cumbersome and kind of awkward to work with, right? So we need so we usually have something like dynamic memory allocation, right? But this is done. This is outside the scope of this very simple scheme, because what you need there is interrupts, memory controller, an operating system. More or less. Yeah. So it's a little bit more complicated, right? But usually, so what happens when you do a memory allocation is that the operating system just gives you a start point where you have the memory allocated, and then as in the program you can just write into it, right? And the operating system handles the memory allocation, so it knows. It knows where. So what you get in your usual program is a virtual address, right? And the operating system knows how to translate the virtual address to the actual physical address, and the operating system handles that. But at the very core, it's just those instructions. It's just additions, storing, loading, multiplication, etc. That's it, right? Interrupts are a little bit more complicated. You need interrupts in order to do the translation from virtual to physical addresses to some degree to make it efficient. We can discuss this in one of the future lectures if you like. Okay. So, what do we gain from pipelining? What's the speed up that we get? So, as I mentioned earlier, each stage in the pipeline, so adding more and more stages increases the overhead because we need to move the data. So not only in time, but also in transistor space, right? And we also need more and more control logic to deal with the hazards, right? It's not necessarily a time factor, a performance factor, but mostly a cost factor in terms of space of transistors that we can spend on the chip, okay? And the biggest problem really is that the overall speed of the entire pipeline is dominated by the slowest stage, okay? So imagine if we were able to split up all the instructions in, I don't know, 100 different stages. If we have just one stage that takes almost forever in terms of CPU cycles, well, we have a problem because we always need to time it such a way that we account for this slowest stage, right? So, what's the speed up that we can gain from pipelining? Okay, so what we try, what we have in the first formula is the time it takes for the, so tau is the time one pipeline stage takes. So we take the maximum out of all stages and add a the worst case delay between the stages, right? So what we get is the one cycle time of a stage, okay? So this is the unit of time that each stage takes, and that's usually the clock frequency, so the inverse of the clock frequency, okay? We have k number of stages, and again, d is the time delay due to overhead, right? So the worst case execution time it takes to execute n instructions is then k plus n minus 1 times tau, right? Depending on the number of stages that we have available, right? So to calculate the speed up, so the gain that we can get from pipelining is then simple, right? We divide, we take one pipeline stage and divide it by some arbitrary amount. So the time it takes for k pipeline stages, and then we are of course interested in the maximum speed up that we can take. So we take the number of instructions to infinity, right? Because usually we execute instructions all over and all over again, right? So we take the number of instructions to infinity, and then the result is that we just get a speed up of k, right? Because the time, the cycle time is canceled out, right? And then we essentially have n here, which in the limit cancels out as well. So we have a maximum speed up of k, right? So this suggests that we really should just try to max out the number of stages that we have available. What we have in this graph is how the speedup really looks like. So we have logarithmic scale of number of instructions, so 10 to the power of x, right? And then the number of stages. So this is more or less a visualization of the speedup formula that I showed earlier, right? So eventually we approach with 6 stages, speedup of 6, with 9 stages, speedup of 9, etc., etc. Right. What you can also see is that the more stages we have, the more instructions we need to actually approach that limit. Right. So here we are in the range of 1,000 instructions, right? Which is still not very much if you consider the frequency of modern CPUs, right? Where we can execute a billion instructions in 1 second, right? So. Okay. So I suggest that we stop here. I think the lecture time's over, right?
Yep.
So I suggest that we stop here. Please register on Studon. Do you have the URL for the Studon registration? I think you came in late, right?
Yeah.